Hello and welcome to WTM Insights Podcast with me, your host, Lisa Francesca Nand. On this episode, direct from WTM London, five industry leaders from Euromonitor International, TUI, EasyJet, Travel Counsellors and Hilton discuss what we can expect for 2019, including consumer confidence, which destinations are doing well and why, the relationships with overseas partners, currency values and, of course, Brexit, hosted by Ben Ross, Deputy Travel Editor of The Telegraph.
WTM is delighted to introduce Ben Ross as our moderator of this afternoon's session, the UK travel market's what to expect in 2019. Ben has been writing about travel for some 17 years and is the deputy head of travel editorial for the Telegraph Media Group and responsible for editorial content across both of the Telegraph's weekend travel sections. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Ben Ross.
Hello, everyone. Thanks so much for coming to this event. As Michael said, the UK travel market's what to expect in 2019. We've got some fantastic panelists joining us for this discussion, which I think, I hope, will be lively and informative, and during which we will probably only mention Brexit 14,000 times. Joining us today will be Andrew Flintham, Managing Director of TUI UK and Ireland, Chris Brown, OBE, Chief Operating Officer of EasyJet, Steve Byrne, CEO of Travel Counsellors, Steve Cassidy, Senior Vice President and Managing Director, UK and Ireland for Hilton, and Caroline Bremner, who's Head of Travel at leading research company Euromonitor International. During my time at Telegraph Travel, I've always done my best to tap into the sort of things that obsess our readers and online users. As a consumer travel section, we always hope to be preeminent at this, to get our expertise out there, as well as delivering the sort of inspirational travel content that our readers crave. I think consumer confidence for 2019 from the point of view of Telegraph readers still seems to remain high, but the biggest part of our online postbag remains the same year on year. Dismay when customer service standards drop, dismay when people don't get value for money, and dismay at perceived rip-offs. That's not to say our readers aren't happy to celebrate the best in travel, but they are a discerning audience, part of the UK travel market that I hope is sophisticated and interested enough to keep those in the travel industry on their toes throughout 2019. That's why, from my point of view, I intend to pick the brains of our panel so that I can get ahead of the game and our readers for the next year. I'm going to be talking to our panel about the key issues that have affected their travel sectors in 2018 and the outcomes expected for 2019. We'll talk about consumer confidence, our relationship with our overseas partners, and how the industry has dealt with terrorism threats and fluctuations in currency values. And then there's the elephant in the room for 2019, Brexit. That's the second reference already, for which I apologize. On this, the biggest issue the UK markets face in 2019, Donald Rumsfeld perhaps had it best in his celebrated quote about known knowns, known unknowns, and unknown unknowns. Well, today with our panel, I hope we can steer a passage through the known unknowns and the known knowns, and frankly, we can leave all the unknown unknowns for another time. We will be asking for any questions you have at the end of our discussion, so do store these up. I'd like to welcome onto the stage now, though, Caroline Bremner, Head of Travel at leading research company Euromonitor International. Caroline manages the global content strategy for the travel and tourism industry at Euromonitor, which she joined back in July 1996 as a global thought leader. I wish I was one of those. Caroline works with analysts across 100 countries to drive strategic insights. Before joining Euromonitor, Caroline was a tour guide in one of Edinburgh's leading tourist attractions, and I, for one, am looking forward to finding out which one.
Thank you, Ben. And it was the Camera Obscura in Edinburgh.
Fantastic. So,
big plug for them. So thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here today. I'm Caroline Bremner, the Head of Travel Research at Euromonitor International. For those of you who don't know who we are, we've been working with WTM for over 10 years, and we have 15 offices around the world. We have a network of 100 analysts that every year work with us on travel and tourism. And so I'm delighted to be able to share with you the results of our research today. We're going to look at, first of all, what's happening in the global travel industry. I know Ben has mentioned Brexit already. We'll leave that to the last. But it's good to look across the world, see who's performing well, who's struggling a little bit, and then take a look at some of the, you know, the confidence indices that we have and just see what the how the travel industry is performing at the moment. So here we are looking at world travel and tourism arrivals. So if we start in 2018, it's very positive. We had a record year last year of growth of 7%. This year we're expecting 1.4 billion arrivals, so people leaving their country and going on holiday for business or work. And what we're expecting is, if you fast forward to 2030, another 12 years out, there's going to be an additional 1 billion arrivals. And the source of that growth is predominantly going to be driven by Asia, including China, India, as well as Southeast Asia in general. So overall, by 2030, we're looking at a very strong tourism economy, 2.4 billion spending, 2.6 trillion. However, on the right there, we've got what's happening with average spending per trip. And what you can see is that it's been sort of slowly coming down over the past couple of decades. And what we're expecting is to see a little bit of a rebound, because of all this volume that's coming out of the travel industry, we're seeing the issue of over-tourism. Many destinations around the world are struggling with too much demand, whether it's Venice, Barcelona, Machu Picchu. And so you can see there's a definite shift towards value-driven, high-value, low-impact travel and tourism. In terms of destinations, on the left there, we have the leading destinations worldwide. This is Euromonitor data based on UNWTO. And then we have a forecast model that predicts what's going to happen out to 2030. Now, France is currently the leading destination worldwide, and that's no secret and has been for many years. But if you look to 2030, you'll see that China is actually going to be the largest destination worldwide. This is a major overtaking of the mature destinations by China, driven by intra-regional demand and middle-class income growth. On the right there, we have the leading source markets. And again, China is a leader in terms of future outbound tourism demand. But you'll still see the US, Germany, UK. And the UK will continue to be a source of strong outbound demand, despite the short-term risks that we see because of Brexit. So overall, looking at regional performance in terms of inbound receipts, as we can see, Asia is the strongest performing region. But what's very interesting is to see the potential that Africa, Middle East holds for travel operators. This is driven by intra-regional demand within Africa and the Middle East, and also recovery in destinations such as Egypt, Turkey, and Tunisia, which is great news for those destinations that were impacted by unrest and uncertainty and terrorism. And North America also continuing to outperform the economy in that region. So who are going to be the winners and losers? Well, we've already talked a lot about China. And in terms of leisure incremental volume, China, Thailand, US, Hong Kong, and France will be the beneficiaries of strong increased tourism demand. It's very interesting to see just how many Asian countries are in that list. So it just shows you where, you know, the shift in power that we're seeing in terms of Asia, not just as an economic driver, but as a driver of tourism growth and jobs and areas like that. On the other side, we have the weaker growth coming from countries such as Denmark, I'm afraid, and then some Caribbean nations, which have been impacted particularly by natural disasters over the past couple of years. On the right there, we have destinations in Europe that have been impacted by terrorism. And the, as I mentioned, Egypt and Turkey suffered very sharp declines 2 years ago, but we've had a rebound, and the capacity is going back into those markets, so that's all positive. And the UK, despite the terror attacks of last year, has performed very well, considering the challenges it's faced. So what's happening in terms of consumers? So yes, we can see the volume is there, we can see the shift to higher spending. But if we look at the consumer confidence index for the UK versus Europe, now it might look like we're heading towards zero, and it is coming down because we're still in a period of great uncertainty. But the good news is that it's actually trending above average. So this is what I would encourage you to take from this chart. But obviously you can see the UK is veering towards that zero level, which is not ideal. So, okay, we left this till last. Here we're going to look at some of the Brexit scenarios. As I mentioned, we have a travel forecast model. We have an excellent team of analysts working with us, and we've developed these different scenarios to look at what potentially could happen. So our baseline, this is what we expect to happen the most, it's the most probable outcome, is that there will be a delayed free trade agreement. So that's got a 52% probability. But then on the other hand, we have a no-deal Brexit, and there's a lot of talk about that, even the government putting together notifications and notices about what might happen with a no-deal Brexit. There is still quite a strong probability of that happening. A light Brexit or a no Brexit, if there were to be another people's referendum, the people's vote, or even no Brexit at all. And then the outcome with the least probability is an early free trade agreement. With less than 5 months to go, I think we can clearly say that there's no chance of that. So what does this mean in terms of travel and tourism? Now, these are scenarios projected on all things being equal. That is, if we continue to have access to the open skies, we continue to have, frictionless and seamless travel between us and the EU, we expect, this is our baseline, to go from 39 million arrivals this year up to around about 49 million. Now, in the case of a no-deal Brexit, let's overlay that, actually, that would have an increasing positive effect on arrivals, because what we would anticipate is that the pound would depreciate by a further 10%, and that would then have a positive knock-on effect on source markets such as Europe and North America, who would see the UK as much more competitive and attractive, and therefore there'd be an uplift in demand. A light Brexit or a no Brexit would be ensue that there would be a slowing of growth, but it's still positive. So overall, when you look at the inbound figures, the picture looks relatively rosy based on our scenario forecasting. As I mentioned, we expect the pound, it's at its lowest level for the past year. It is sort of depreciating, as you can see. Clearly, we need to have a bit more clarity on what's happening with the deal. Maybe our panelists might have some insider knowledge on what's going on there. But as you can see, the pound is depreciating. So that was, we were looking at the inbound, and now we're going to focus on the outbound market. So for tour operators and airlines, you can see that the baseline is in the dark blue, and we're expecting about 85 million arrivals next year to go up to about 110 million. Now, if there were to be a no-deal Brexit, that, of course, would be the worst-case scenario for UK consumers, because the pound would depreciate, it would be tougher for them to go abroad, things would be more expensive. And obviously, the confidence levels in the consumer spectrum would be much, much lower. So overall, we would expect, in the case of a no-deal Brexit, a decline next year in terms of outbound trips, picking up towards the midterm. And of course, all those destinations that rely on UK source market, the UK as a source market, Spain in particular, we would expect to see a hit of almost £2 billion. And then we would have also the US, France, Portugal, all sort of taking a little bit of a hit in the case of a no deal. But I'm sure as a group, we can sort of think positive thoughts, and over to the panel with all their great insights to hear what they think as well. Thank you very much. Okay.
Caroline, so the solution is we need to think positive thoughts about Brexit. Excellent.
Mindful. Yeah. Positive thoughts.
I'm intrigued by, I think we'll get to the Brexit as a discussion shortly, but I wonder if you might be able to talk a little bit about some of the other sort of structural changes in the UK market that we might want to talk about in a more long-term situation.
Well, when you look at the long-term, what you see is an aging population.
Right.
I also had a look at the sort of income and expenditure for the UK to 2030. And what you're seeing actually is growing inequality in the UK and the fact that we're going to have a rise in the lower to middle class income levels. So by 2030, there's going to be something like 22 million social class D households,
right,
plus 18 million from class E. So what you're seeing is a very sort of bottom-heavy sort of income levels. So I think the industry as a whole is going to suffer from this sort of price competitiveness, this search for value for money. And I think, you know, regardless of what we're seeing with Brexit, there are some challenges, an aging population, growing income disparity, and obviously the fact that young people have less money than their parents did. Whereas it's the opposite in Asia. If you look at Asia, as you know, what's happening in Asia, it's a sort of growth success story. Young people have more money in their pockets, more disposable income for them to travel abroad.
I was worried when you, well, worried, concerned that when we were looking at your graphs, that the beneficiaries of strong demand, the UK isn't in that list.
Well, I think in terms of an inbound destination, and it is, and outbound, it's still growing. So I think the positive is that it, you know, we're not seeing a decline. It's just slower growth. And of course, the UK market is a mature market. And it's natural that the growth will come from fast-growing economies such as China, India, Thailand, Indonesia, etc.
Fantastic. Right, I think it's time to bring on the rest of our panel. First up, I'd like to introduce Andrew Flintham, who became managing director of TUI UK and Northern Ireland in March and has worked for the travel firm for over 13 years. Prior to joining the company, Andrew worked in a number of positions for British Airways, having begun his career with the Ford Motor Company after graduating from Southampton University with the key professional requirement for anyone in travel, a geography degree. Next up, Chris Brown, OBE, joined the airline management board at EasyJet as chief operating officer in October 2016 and is responsible for all operational departments in the airline. Chris has previously held several senior leadership positions within aviation, including chief operating officer aviation of TUI Travel, managing director Thomson Airways, and managing director First Choice Airways. She won her OBE for services to aviation and has a doctorate of science for outstanding services to aviation. So I'm guessing she's here in some way to talk about trains. Steve Byrne, CEO of Travel Counsellors. Travel Counsellors is an independent, people-focused and technology-enabled travel business that provides customised holiday and corporate travel packages to 450,000 customers each year. It has 180,000 travel counsellor franchises and 350 support staff in seven countries. Steve joined the company in 2004 and has been part of the team that has seen the business deliver 10 years of successive record growth, with sales this year in excess of $600 million. In 2014, Steve led a management buyout of the business and recently steered the company through a secondary buyout. And finally, Steve Cassidy is Senior Vice President and Managing Director, UK and Ireland of Hilton, and is responsible for the company's multi-brand portfolio across the British Isles. He joined Hilton's revenue management team in 2009, moving into hotel operations in September 2011. His remit expanded in 2015 to include all Hilton's owned and managed properties in the UK and Ireland. And in 2017, Steve oversaw the opening of more than one hotel a month in the UK, which is madness. He is chairman of the Hospitality Guild and a board director of the British Hospitality Association. Please welcome all my panelists onto stage. Do you know, I think we should start by just making sure everyone in the room is absolutely convinced of what everyone up here does. So, Andrew, for anyone in the room not familiar with TUI, which I imagine is very few, can you give a very brief overview of the business as you see it and your role within it and how you found things over the past year or so?
Okay. So TUI UK as part of TUI Group, which is the world's leading integrated leisure company. So we're the world's largest. And we are the UK's largest holiday company. So we take around 6 million people on holiday every year. Distribute our holidays, sell our holidays through our own chain of shops. We have around 600 retail outlets. We fly our customers predominantly on our own airline. We have 63 aircraft. And we produce a whole range of different holidays, from the what you would classify as our traditional kind of 7 and 14 night beach holidays, but also multi-center holidays, long-haul holidays. We have a cruise company called Morella Cruises, and we have the Crystal Ski brand. So a whole range of different holiday options.
And would you say
options.
That range that you referred to just then is part of the expanding element of TUI's portfolio?
Yeah, I think one of the strategies of the business has been to almost take its success in that traditional space and almost move out and continue to add elements that customers are interested in, that customers really want to partake in.
Chris?
Hi.
EasyJet seems to have survived relatively unscathed over the past year or so, where other airlines have faltered. I'm thinking of the collapse of Monarch and Air Berlin last year. BA's technical problems. Ryanair's ongoing desire to seek good publicity wherever it can find it. How has EasyJet managed it, and how has your role as COO helped steer this course?
I mean, honestly, it's been a really successful year for us at EasyJet. And if I think back to this time last year, you're quite right. We were faced with the collapse of Monarch, Air Berlin, the woes of Alitalia, and then the others that you mentioned. So we did what I think we always do with great aplomb, is that stick to our strengths, decided which strategy that we wanted to build upon. And if you look at it, what EasyJet is really successful at is that fantastic network across Europe, the brand proposition that our customers love, and the customer proposition from what our customers tell us that they love about EasyJet, the digital leadership itself, and the cost performance. Which is really low cost, which means we can continue to offer low fares to our customers. So that led us to take the rather ambitious and rather challenging position to actually take on part of Air Berlin. Now, EasyJet, until that point, was not very strong in Germany. So this time last year, I had no aircraft, I had no crew, but we wanted to start flying on the 5th of January. And guess what? We did that in less than 90 days. And we've had tremendous success, not just in Europe, but I mean the performance in Germany has been stellar.
And EasyJet itself, I mean, one of the things I think we always perceive in the UK is that it's in some way a British airline, that we're invested in some
point.
Way, and we buy into the orange logo, and we have it all as part of our hearts, like Marks and Spencers or something like that.
Actually, do you know something? Whilst EasyJet is the largest airline in the UK, we've got over 300 aircraft now, 319 flying right now as we speak, actually. Carrying 90 million customers this year. So basically on a daily basis, it's about 2,000 flights and almost 300,000 people every single day, day in and day out. And hopefully most people enjoy it and on time. But that's not just the UK. You know, 40% of our customers come nowhere near the UK. It's in Europe. EasyJet is the second largest airline in France and actually is well loved by our French customers. So yeah, it truly is a European organization.
You were saying before when we were speaking outside that every morning you have to watch all the planes. So you get a little email saying they've all gone off safely.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, as chief operating officer, the buck stops with me. You would expect that, wouldn't you? Yeah. So my husband says I'm a bit of a control freak. Yeah. So I'm never off the phone because, you know, honestly, with a scale of operation that size, it's down to me to make sure that it's a successful and most importantly, a safe operation.
Steve Byrne. Travel counsellors, can you give me a sense? I mean, I've got a real idea that you're about the human touch and a sense of reconnecting in travel, but can you give me an idea of how you've grown over the past years and what you think the particular core strength of the brand is?
The business has grown on average by about 16% every year for the past 16 years. That's accelerated in the past 3 years where it's been 20%. So we sort of double in size every 3 to 5 years. The business isn't really about the brand. The business is about individuals forming connections with their customers at a human-to-human level. So unlike a lot of people, I guess, on the panel or in the room, we operate in a very particular market, which is those customers who want human-to-human assisted travel. We've analysed the size of that market and the potential growth in that market, both in leisure and corporate travel. And like everyone on the platform, we're about building trust with our customers in an age when people are losing trust in branded institutions, but we want to build trust at a human-to-human level, where we build a fantastic level of relationships and intimacy with individual customers, and we're the wrapper that sits around that. And our job is to enable our people to do a fantastic job for their customers. So we try and keep it simple, and ultimately we're all about the same thing: finding a customer and keeping them, and that's what we try and do.
But there's something slightly counterintuitive about that. I would have said 5 years ago, 10 years ago, the narrative was all about losing the human interaction, about simplicity, about ordering the thing that you wanted off the internet because you were empowered and you had the information at hand. How do you bring the human element into that mix?
Well, there's a lovely quote from Tony Robbins. I don't think he originated it, but he said, in the internet age, people are drowning in information, but being starved of wisdom. So there is still a demand from a certain segment of customer that wants that insight and advice. The great thing about an event like World Travel Market is it reminds you of the passion that there is for travel. It's the emotive and emotional subject, and it matters for people, and it matters when it goes wrong. There's still a significant element of the population who know that they can book their travel online, they can know they can do it themselves, and in some cases get a cheaper price, but they choose to book with a fellow human being because of the way that human being makes them feel. And that's what we do. And if you're in business, you've got to be clear what business you're in, and that's what business we are in.
Steve Cassidy from Hilton. I'm assuming everyone in this room has heard of Hilton, so we won't need to go too much into the history of the brand. But it'd be really interesting to hear how Hilton's 2018 has gone and how you go about different. It's 13 brands you have, isn't it? How you manage to differentiate all of those brands within the marketplace itself.
Yeah, we're up to 15 now.
15, sorry.
So,
15.
Just launched a couple last week. But I'm glad everybody in the room has heard of Hilton, because it has been...
We should have a show of hands.
Let's not test that one. Yeah, but it has been 100 years in the making. We're celebrating our 100-year anniversary this year, in fact. And yes, you're right. We're now 15 brands across the world. Some 5,600 hotels open, in the process of building a further nearly 2,500 hotels. So... when you ask the question, how are things going, very well in that context. And I think, you know, when you look at these kind of mega trends around travel and the mega trend around experience, I couldn't agree more with what Steve says. That's at the front and center of our business. And in fact, what distinguishes Hilton from other solutions from a accommodation perspective, we recognize that we are a business of people serving people. That's what hospitality is, and that's what Hilton is all about. And for us to ride this wave of this mega trend of travel is about delivering personalized experiences to our guests. So whether that's in each and every hotel, every day, wherever, whichever brand, whichever country out of the 106 that we operate that we are, or whether it's through some of the innovation that we apply. We're very proud of some of the digital innovation that we've recently launched. I mean, Hilton back in the day was the first one to do the Pina Colada. We're the first organization to put TVs into hotel bedrooms, and we're now launching the ability to digitally choose a room and check in and go straight to your room and unlock the door with an app. But that doesn't mean we're removing people, because through that process, there's still the need for that interaction. That's what enhances this holistic experience proposition.
It does feel a little like you're removing people from the model. If realistically you're transferring from the outside of Hilton Hotel to your bedroom without having spoken to anyone, is this something that would apply across... Presumably you're only specifically... delivering this in certain brands rather than all the Hilton.
Well, nearly half of our open hotels now have this capability, and it's growing as the technology gets put into the hotels. That capability is there, and this is back to the personalization agenda. It's about choice. So we're giving travelers the choice to bypass some of those processes. There's at a particular point in time during a particular part of their journey, they may not feel adds value, and they wish to go direct to the room. However, when they want to talk to somebody, when they want to get some advice on where to go to have an experience outside the hotel, there's experts at hand that are able to facilitate that.
So the concierge isn't going to end up on an app?
We still have concierges in our hotels, but we also have the capability on our apps to provide similar type services. It's choice.
Caroline, hotels, I would have thought, are one of the great areas where currency is really, really important in terms of whether we will have people travelling to the UK and beyond in our markets. How badly does currency reflect that?
Currency is in pound sterling.
Yeah.
I mean, as I said in my presentation, currency is, you know, it's one of the drivers, but there's a multitude of drivers, and it's also about value for money. So yes, it will help. You know, it might convince somebody to do a short-term break at the last minute, but a lot of people are booking in advance, and so it really is about the UK offering choice. And I think what we have in the UK is a very sort of mature market with lots of segmentation in the hotel industry. Equally, we've seen the phenomenal rise of the sharing economy, the brands such as Airbnb. Again, that sort of helps to offer diversification and that sort of choice that's really important for consumers. There, you know, we have research that shows that, you know, the number one value priority for a consumer is convenience and things to be seamless. But then the second value is the priority of having choice and flexibility.
But presumably a weak sterling currency reflects very well for UK hotels in general.
Yes, it will.
Right. Andrew, just in terms of destinations, how do you see the market for UK travellers, Brexit aside, operating next year? Are there particular areas that you're excited about in terms of outbound?
Yeah, I mean, I think you saw us on the slides quite clearly. We've seen a real reversal to a degree of the shift when a few years ago everything came from east to west. We're now starting to see that reversal of that that demand coming back to those destinations such as Egypt and Turkey, which is great because we almost ended up with quite an imbalanced picture for a period in the fact there was a lot of supply in some of those markets but not a lot of demand, and there was a huge amount of demand in some of those Western Mediterranean destinations, and guess what? Still the same amount of supply. So that was quite a difficult picture to manage. So I think we're seeing a bit more of a balanced picture, which is really good. And there is some really great high quality product that's almost coming back to being in vogue. The other thing I'd say is as well, when you kind of start to move down the Adriatic coast, there is a whole host of great development going on, be it in Croatia, be it in Montenegro. Lots of those markets are becoming increasingly attractive and quite exciting for consumers. And then I think the final piece is people still love long haul. So people still love the really exotic destinations. So we just launched Los Cabos. So we're adding more and more, we talked about Mexico, adding more and more Mexican capacity to our program going forward. We've expanded our Asian programs, so our Thailand programs, our Vietnam programs. So it's a real mix and broadness, but I think it is a maybe a move a little bit away from some of those more traditional destinations, even though they will still make up the lion's share of our destination portfolio when you look at it in absolute terms.
Do you still have I mean, obviously you must be concerned that terrorism might impact on some of those markets that are coming back this year. How do you mitigate that when you're planning your operations in the course of 2019?
I mean, the way that we plan our programs are to have as balanced a program as possible, which is why actually when you're in a concentrated position, it's quite difficult. So to have a bigger balance, because we can make adjustments as seasons go on when events, however tragic, may happen and may or may not happen in various destinations. I think there is also a terrible reality, and it is a terrible reality, that terrorism is pretty much everywhere. It can happen in London, it can happen in Paris, it can happen in the States, it can happen in a holiday destination. So I think almost, whereas if you went back 5 years, you would see an extremely polarized reaction to an individual incident, I think almost terribly there is a realism that, that those things almost happen everywhere, and therefore the effects of those changes are maybe slightly more subdued than they've been in the past.
The sense I've always had from our readership is they're quite resilient anyway. I mean, the UK travellers will do almost anything to travel. They're unlikely to be put off by things for too long in general. And presumably that's what we're seeing with the return to Egypt, with the return to Turkey.
And you do have customers that have a huge affinity with the destination. So when we had the tragic events in Tunisia, we obviously couldn't operate to Tunisia for some considerable period of time while the security situation changed. We would have forward seasons on sale, maybe 18 months away. We would have the same group of customers that would book with us. And then when we couldn't operate it because the situation hadn't changed and we moved it to another 6 months later, they would also rebook for 6 months because they just desperately wanted to go back to Tunisia. You've had the same thing with Sharm el-Sheikh. Customers finding any way to get to Sharm el-Sheikh despite the fact they can't actually go through the airport. There is a real affinity for people and people really want to have those holidays. So yes, I think it is true.
And Chris, from your point of view, looking forward to 2019, I understand that the summer sale that you've had earlier this year has been one of the best you've ever had at EasyJet. So there must be a sort of inbuilt and ready-to-use sense of consumer confidence out there that you can tap into.
Absolutely. It was amazing. We filled like something equivalent of 7 A320s in a matter of minutes as soon as the program went on sale. We're already flying to over 1,000 routes, so we've got pretty much a lot of Europe already covered. And indeed, the new destinations for the forthcoming year are Jordan, Denmark, Poland, and Finland, actually. Some new and exciting destinations to the already, multitude of destinations we fly to already.
So is the goal with EasyJet always to expand the destination options for UK travellers, do you think?
I think when we sit down and decide where we're going to fly to and from, it has to have a tremendous element of responsibility in the decisions that we're making as well. And that plays a big part. But I've never been anywhere where there is just so much demand. There are so many options. But there's only so much growth that we will deliver responsibly. So there are tremendous opportunities out there for us as we see going forward, not just 2019, but beyond.
Steve, in terms of your business, what do you think are the biggest things that are going to affect it next year? Again, if we can postpone talking about Brexit, is it about price? Is it about inflation? What are the things that are going to stop people booking with you or tempt them to?
You try and avoid, I think, getting drawn into making strategic decisions based on tactical circumstances. Otherwise, you'll make short-term decisions. This sounds a little bit corporate, so bear with me. But if you're running a business, you get paid to take a long-term view. And what's the right thing long-term for your customers and for your people and for your company? So you need to be cognizant of any short-term factors and turn them to your advantage, but it shouldn't get in the way of your decision-making. So the things that are going to impact on our business are no different from they were 12 months ago, which is our ability to make sure that we're clear about what sort of customers we want to try and attract. We give them the very best experience, and we find the right quality of people, and we need superb people to deliver that experience for the customer, though that's no different from what was before. We have to carry on investing in technology to enhance the experience for the customer and enable our people to be relevant and appropriate. So I think they remain the big macro things. At a tactical level, what have we learned from the past 12 months? People do book in advance, and the airlines play a major factor in people's desire to want to book in advance based on how they price their product. For those that don't book in advance, you do see a lot of tactical decision making based on the foreign exchange rate. So you'll see people proactively switch from one destination to another if they're given the opportunity because of the relative price competitiveness of those destinations. You're only seeing an increasing number of people who are traveling in larger groups, where you have got people who share the pitfall of being as old as I am, who can now afford to pay for their wider family to go on holiday. So you're seeing some of that. And you are seeing, I think, regardless of destination, a general, although it's not in every instance, a general desire to want to try and make sure that the trip is different or memorable, even in what might seem a very small way to us provider, but means a lot to the customer.
And that's going to affect, surely, the hotel market just as much. The idea that you can offer something that will be memorable and will live on in people's minds. How do you do that in the coming year? How do you enhance your offering continuously so that people are going to feel like they're going to get that special experience in a Hilton hotel? Yes, it's you, Hilton.
I mean, I think the initial question was about what's going to stop people traveling. I mean, we're very focused on what's going to make people travel and give them the best possible experience. And, you know, I talked about the personalization agenda that we have before. Every customer is different. Every customer is traveling for different reasons. And it's critically important that we're not offering that cookie cutter solution, that we are offering differentiation. The opposite of differentiation is commoditization. There's a danger of being in this sea of sameness. And what we're very committed to in Hilton is about delivering differentiated experience, using digital platforms to enable that, as one example. But critically important, it's about the customer experience. It's this point I made before around being a business of people serving people, and we can deliver bespoke, personalized, unique experiences and outstanding value through our people.
Are there any specific issues that face the UK market, people staying in British hotels that are perhaps different in Hilton around the world? Are there any particular demographics that are different in the UK?
Well, the source markets do change all the time. I mean, this year has been a fascinating year in terms of, big adjustments in source market, partly driven by the exchange rate point that's been made a lot. But we've had a phenomenally successful year, and that's been one major source market for the UK has been the Middle East. It's been an incredibly strong market out of the Middle East and into the UK. Likewise, the US source market to the UK has been incredibly strong, doubtless relating to the sterling factor in particular. But I mean, let's not underestimate. We want to put great value experiences and great products in the markets with the brands that our customers want us to be. I love working in the UK because it gives me an incredible platform, because we have an amazing product here in the UK for business and for leisure tourists. So long may that continue.
Absolutely. I think we can all get behind that as an idea. You mentioned very briefly, Caroline, in your presentation, over-tourism as an issue. Is that something that you see actually genuinely defining where people will want to be travelling next year? Will they be put off by the news stories about Venice being overcrowded or Barcelona being too busy for tourists?
I think it's a very complex issue. And I think when you take a destination like Barcelona, people feel that affinity and, you know, they're very loyal to it. But then obviously if you go to Barcelona and you do experience the crowds, you see the cruise ships coming in and sort of flooding the center of the town, then it is quite off-putting. And then what you also have is the Catalonian tourism board saying, well, there's more to Catalonia than Barcelona. There's like the whole of the internal part, there's the mountains, there's the coast. So I think, you know, it's also offering up more choice to consumers. And we see that with the new, lots of new tourism strategies, such as what's going on in Scotland, the opening up of the East Coast with the launch of the V&A, the North Coast 500. We see in Iceland where they've created the route number one, the highway. And so again, it's about taking visitors out of those core tourist hot spots like Reykjavik or whatever, Edinburgh, and then sort of spreading that wealth. So I feel that it's kind of a combination. Yes, there's like the media focus on over-tourism, but then equally the destinations are as keen to mitigate it as as they can.
Certainly, editorially, working in the, from a journalistic perspective, the goal is always, from our point of view, to make sure that you're making people think outside the normal box. So we have an enormous number of readers at The Telegraph, for example, who know Tuscany very, very well. And we're definitely trying to make them explore slightly beyond that at all times. And presumably, from a TUI point of view, you've... with the advent of the Dreamliner, for example, you managed to expand your portfolio almost on an instant, just with the result of a new bit of technology that took you to a different part of the world suddenly, very simply.
Yeah, I think the whole sustainability piece for being a scale tour operator is quite an interesting one, because we plan in advance where we go, so actually that very, very long term in advance, that also gives us the opportunity to work proactively with those destinations. So you're right, the 787 Dreamliners were a way of us accessing a whole new world of destinations in the most environmentally friendly manner. And in fact, our UK airline is the world's most carbon efficient airline. So sustainability wise, you know, people say, how can you try and be sustainable if you have an airline or a cruise operation? But actually, people will want to fly on aircraft and they will want to go on cruise ships. Therefore, you have to try and do it in the most sustainable way possible. We've created a thing called the TUI Care Foundation. So our customers donate around 7 million euros a year. We put that into destinations, mainly around children, education, or providing jobs. But it's all about providing a sustainable balance for those environments that we're taking people to, because we all know that if we damage those environments, and I think Venice is the classic example of at what point does Venice become so busy that nobody actually really wants to go to Venice anymore. But if we plan it appropriately, then you actually enhance the environment through that development, and very much it's a benefit for all, which is really what we want tourism to be.
And Chris, in terms of flying environmentally and making sure that EasyJet is at the forefront of that, I hear electric planes is the way to go.
Well, I mean, you can never say never. I mean, Andrew talked about the 787. I was intricately involved in the development of that aircraft, because we could see that, you know, when you're bringing emissions down by 20% by burning less fuel, and indeed 60% less noise, because it's not just about fuel, it's about noise reduction as well. It's so important. We're operating one of the most modern fleets in Europe with the 320, 320, 321 and the 319s. We've seen a tremendous improvement as well with the NEO engine, which is actually now reducing fuel burn by 15%, and then noise by a subsequent 50%. And that will always be at the core of EasyJet, to operate a modern, efficient fleet. As far as the electric planes are concerned, yeah, well, why not? I mean, there's a very interesting company called The Wright Company. They're at the forefront of developing this, and we've said, well, let's work together to see if we can actually make this work. Now, it'll not be taken off today or tomorrow, don't worry about that. But, I mean, we do not know what this industry or what technology will bring in the next 15 to 20 years, but change it, there will be.
And Steve, in terms of travel councils, obviously technology, as you mentioned, is at the heart of what you're doing. Are there is that to do with complexity and trying to make that a simpler and simpler task in terms of the people you talk to? I was struck by you saying that you were taking an awful lot of people on multi-generational, on more complicated itineraries. Presumably that's where your future will lie in terms of 2019, the really complex holidays. You need a human being at the end of it in order to book that.
Right, I mean, the greater degree of complexity, arguably the greater degree of the need for someone to assist you with those travel plans. I think technology and talent underpins every business, doesn't it? So, I mean, I think we have to, if you look at the big four tech businesses, what they spend on R&D, no business can compete with. But nevertheless, in the context of your own business, it's really important to make sure that you do have a clear approach to innovation and research and development, so you're thinking about where you'll need to be in the future rather than where you are now. I think increasingly, if you want to attract the very best people, so the sustainable tourism issue is not just important from a customer point of view and from an ethics point of view, it's also an important point of view from talent and talent acquisition and development. People want to know what you stand for. and that you're making a positive contribution to society at large. So having a proactive, positive approach to your sense of purpose, and that includes, I think, sustainable tourism is important, yes, from a customer point of view, but also that you use it as a rallying cry to attract and keep the very best talent, because I think those things matter to people that want to work for companies.
And Steve, at Hilton, that must be exactly the same. Sustainability presumably is at the heart of what you'll be doing going forward. Do you have any particular examples of how Hilton are going to manage that? Because the hotel industry is inherently quite wasteful.
Yeah. Thanks. we have a footprint, and it's important that that we manage that. I mean, we've made a commitment. We have made a commitment recently that by 2030 we're going to half our carbon footprint, our footprint and impact on the community, and also that we will double our contribution to the communities that we serve. And I think that's critically important in any big business of our size. It's a management and franchise business, that we get out there very early, those targets and those commitments that not only can we work with through our team members and our hotels, but we can work with our owners and partners around achieving them. So we've got very clear goals, because we don't underestimate the impact that we have in our communities. That we are a business of hospitality. We're embedded within the communities that we serve, and it's critically important that's a two-way relationship.
Right. I did promise that during the course of this conversation we would talk about Brexit, and I feel we have to do that now. If in any conversation about 2019 and what the UK markets can expect, that's obviously a fundamental in it. We heard earlier today Susan Hooper from the Department for Exiting the EU basically telling a room full of travel leaders that they should just prepare for the worst and hope for the best, which, given the time at our disposal, feels like quite a sort of frightening way to be perceiving what is going to be one of the largest things that happens to the UK travel industry and the UK in general in 2019. I think I should start with you, Caroline, on this. The model that you put up there, you managed to paint a fairly positive interpretation of what might be happening in terms of inbound. And indeed, it didn't look as frightening as I was expecting it to be in terms of outbound. But are there any things in that model that you haven't... I mean, you're assuming that some sort of deal will happen with that model, aren't you?
Well, what the model can't take account of is if there are no flights, if there's like a complete grounding of all the flights. So there's this sense that, you know, that surely won't happen. And but if it does, then obviously we'll have to change the model. But yes, the no-deal Brexit is more about not having access to the custom union, not having access to the single market, and what that means in terms of trade intensity and things like that. But overall, it does kind of depend on which perspective you're looking at. On the inbound side, you know, the growth is there. On the outbound side, if there were to be a no-deal Brexit, obviously that would have a short-term impact, as, you know, it's unprecedented. There might be a slight decline, but then it would recover as things become clearer. So it all depends on certainty and then how that's conveyed to consumers and businesses. I was looking at the latest IPS data, and you can actually see that into the UK, it's business travel that is down, whereas leisure travel is sort of, you know, maintaining a relatively okay level of growth. So I think businesses are feeling that uncertainty.
Steve, I read some data last week that said that 3 in 5 stated Brexit will not change their holiday plans at all, and that only a small fraction will take fewer holidays, and that 14% expect to spend more time in the UK, which is presumably quite good news for Hilton UK.
No, potentially. What Brexit has done is just put a big dollop of uncertainty into the business community in particular. But I've had a good year. The numbers are looking pretty decent. We're coming... we're managing to get business and good leisure traffic from the US and from the Middle East, as I mentioned before. So overall, things are fine. The decision making, particularly amongst business, is a bit later in the cycle, not surprisingly, considering that level of uncertainty. And the sooner we can remove that, then the better. And then I think it will be, a much kind of cleaner flying going forward. The one area we'll pick up on, which does concern me, I mean, clearly we do have all our contingency plans, as most business do, around a no-deal scenario. But regardless of no-deal or any of the other scenarios, we have to recognize that this kind of UK product that I mentioned before, which is incredibly strong and incredibly attractive and is fueling this growth that we've seen, and in our business in particular, is international visitors being served by international people. And there are frankly not enough UK employees to fill that gap of international employees. So the one area that I think we're working very hard with government and messaging is around that point, and ensuring that we can continue to have access to those skills going forward in our country.
And Steve Byrne, presumably you're with your travel councils based around the world and being able to feedback it from local environments, that's got to stay going forward with post-Brexit. You've got to be able to employ these people. You've got to be able to operate on that sort of level from now on, haven't you?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's no doubt it potentially does pose some significant structural issues for certain businesses, depending on your business model. And the one that cuts across everything, I think, is aviation. Yeah. But notwithstanding that, which is an easy thing to say, you've got to be an optimist in business. And I do genuinely, I believe in business. I believe business is a power of good and a power of positive change, and regardless, and hopefully the solution is business and trade friendly, but regardless of the outcome, I do believe that entrepreneurship and entrepreneurs and business will find a way around it. It just might take a little bit longer and might cost a few pennies more, but ultimately we'll find a way of making this work. And I would rather it will be helpful, but if it is more difficult, we'll find a way, because that is just the nature of human endeavor, and that is the nature of business. And if you run a business, there's loads of things you can find to make you really depressed, and this is one of them. So don't let it, and have a positive attitude towards it, because your people need you to be up for it and able to inspire them.
Here. Chris, if we don't get agreement over open skies or membership of the European Airline Safety Agency, all the flights stop flying on the 1st of April, don't they?
Certainly. Hope not. But what we had to do, in fact, I remember, because it was one of the first tasks that the team and I faced at EasyJet, is what are we going to do? Well, for starters, I do believe and hope that common sense will prevail, and all the negotiations we have had, both with the Commission and indeed with our own governments and indeed other European governments, is that, you know, they've said, even in the event of a hard Brexit, that there will be a bare bones agreement in place. Having said that, we took the decision 2 years ago that we'd rather be in charge of our own destiny. So what are we going to do about it? So I wouldn't want to tell you the amount of work that has gone in to our post-Brexit structure. And that is just to be able to do what we do today, i.e., you know, fly 90 million customers around Europe, you know, with great service, you know, and low fares. So what that meant was setting up another European airline. So that was last year. We set up an Austrian, what we call an AOC, your license to fly. We've still got our UK airline, obviously, and we've got an airline in Switzerland. Now, that effectively means that we will retain those traffic rights to be able to fly to and from the UK and indeed within Europe. But within that, we've had to relicense our pilots onto European licenses, not just CAA licenses, attestations for our crew. Wow, the hours, you know, that have gone into actually securing that structure has been absolutely phenomenal. So I would say we are pretty confident and pretty well prepared that come April Fool Day, terrible day, that, you know, we'll be able to fly across Europe. It's the least that our customers and our people deserve from us.
Extraordinary, though, that you're having to put all this effort in.
Correct.
Essentially just to maintain.
Correct.
The status quo.
Well, it's our insurance policy, isn't it? And quite frankly, whilst we debated it long and hard over the past few years, I'm really glad that we did it. I wouldn't be sitting here as comfortable and as confident as I am now had we not taken all those brave, big, bold decisions back then. You know.
Brave, big, bold decisions for TUI as well?
Yeah, so I mean, it's quite interesting when you hear everybody talking about it, you realise that you don't talk to them. These are the people that I've known Chris for many years, but that you never met before. We're all doing exactly the same things as businesses. The cost of all this has been all the energy and effort that we've had to put in place to create that insurance policy when we could have been doing other things. So there is definitely almost a lost opportunity, but we can't let it get in the way of an optimistic future. So, you know, we're not letting it get in the way of any of our investment decisions. We have to take sometimes a two or three different version of a Brexit lens on those investment decisions to fully understand, can we actually do this in this scenario? Can we do it in that scenario? But we're not letting it get in the way. So the business is carrying on full steam ahead because it has to, because the world will carry on, I'm sure, after April the 1st. And let's hope that the worst thing that happens isn't the revision of the model.
I think we've got some time for questions from the floor. Does anyone out there have anything they want to ask the panel? Nothing.
Nothing.
Come on. Okay. On the basis that no one else wants to ask this question, if you were going to ask one thing of our leaders at the moment in terms of Brexit, assuming that Brexit is going to happen in the way that people assume it is going to happen, what would it be? Andrew.
Certainty. Exactly. However unpalatable we might think the outcome is, certainty so that you can actually properly get to grips with it and work with it.
Chris?
I couldn't agree more. You took the words out of my mouth. Better the misery of certainty, isn't it, rather than the uncertainty of whatever the saying
is. Whichever way around it is.
You know what, whatever way around it is. That's it. That's what businesses need.
Yeah. And the unknown unknowns.
We need to be able to plan. We need to be able to forge on with our future. And the country is depending on that.
Steve, from Travel Council's perspective?
How does the solution make life better for businesses to create wealth and employment?
That is a big question of Brexit, I think. Okay, fine. And Steve, for you?
Get a deal done.
Just get it done. Yeah.
Get a deal done and recognise the importance of skills to our industry.
Yeah. And Caroline, when you're hearing back from businesses, is that the narrative that you get? Just get it done, give us clarity?
Well, we work with like lots of clients around the world, and yes, it is about sort of, as you can see, destinations that are depending on UK outbound, so destinations like Spain or wherever, just yes, it's what's going to happen. How do we continue to encourage UK visitors to come to our destinations? And that's where it is about value for money, where it is about having the access, where it is about having the routes, but equally having a sort of responsible and sustainable sort of travel product as well.
Right. Do we really have no questions from the floor? Does anyone have their hand up here in the front row?
Hiya. Hi. Just a question. What do you think has been the most significant thing that you've done in preparation for Brexit? Of course, you've taken a lot of action. You outlined it just there. But what's the largest, most risky decision?
I think undoubtedly to be able to have set up the Austrian airline. We've now got 123 aircraft registered on the Austrian fleet, and to set up what we call that group interoperability. It's a very fine word of saying, but effectively that guarantees that we can fly today. Tomorrow the same way that we fly today. That was it was an investment required. It was an awful lot of reorganisation. But what we wanted to do as well was, by doing that, not to complicate the model either, because we'll only be competitive if we can continue to keep our costs low and offer low fares to our customers. But that, I think, was the riskiest decision, choosing which country we had to do it, because we started with 27, came down to Austria, who, I have to say, the authorities have been fantastic, working both with ourselves here in the UK, with the Swiss and with the Austrians. That was actually trying to untangle all of that. It may seem simple now, but it certainly wasn't back then. But I'm really glad that we did that, because I still hope we like to say that we offer the warmest welcome in the sky, and hopefully come 1st of April we can still do that.
And you're not afraid about appetite for travel between the UK and Europe lessening?
Look, I mean, I don't have a crystal ball. I can't predict that future. But so far, we're not seeing the impact of that. I mean, the sooner we get certainty, although around that, the better it is, as Andrew said. We do not believe that the main holidays will be impacted. But maybe around the start, if there is more uncertainty, that could impact, you know, customer demand. But so far, we're not seeing that, which is why we need something certain soon.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Can I ask the panel, when you're dealing with destinations, when you're liaising with the people on the ground, what's their perception of what we're going through in the UK at the moment?
I think there was a collective shock that we actually voted to do what we did in the first place. Once we'd got through that, every meeting being that, then it's they want exactly the same as we do. They want us to be able to be in a position where we can commit in the normal way that we would to a program and a set of customers coming to their destination. And if that uncertainty just passes itself over to all those other economies and all that other good that tourism brings. So it's exactly the same effect, both externally and internally.
You know, I would say for us, in all the countries that we've visited and been speaking to, there was a tremendous amount of, dare I say, sadness. Did not want the UK to leave Europe. And then again, at the time, back to your earlier question as well, it was quite unsettling for our crew, for our people, too. So we had to spend an awful lot of time, obviously, trying to understand their concerns and trying to find and come up with mitigating actions to make sure that they could rest, you know, assured that their jobs were safe and they can keep on doing what they do today. And one of the things that I should have said when we talked about the demise of Air Berlin, you know, when you're doing a big deal like that, you tend to focus on the transaction itself, on the slots, on the safe operating of the aircraft as well. But I went several months ago just to back to Berlin, and the crew, some of them were in tears because they said, "Chris, you don't realise, you know, you've given us our careers back. You've given us our future. You know, can you rest assured that EasyJet will still be here post Brexit? You know, so we cannot underestimate the impact that this is having on a global." A global workforce, you know.
And in terms of Hilton, you mentioned your multinational workforce. Is there a sense of despair or a sense of just again wanting to know what's going on?
There's a lot of different emotions. I've been flying around in the couple of years, and I share and concur with those views. I mean,
hope you're flying with me.
Sorry.
Hope you're flying with us.
You know, amongst our European workers, there's the obvious uncertainty about what the future looks like in terms of right to remain status, etc. So we're, you know, trying to help reassure where we possibly can in that regard. But look, I mean, I'll go back to the bigger picture here. You know, the mega trend is fantastic. You know, our product here in the UK is incredible. For my business and all the businesses that are represented here, I think we're doing an incredible job at offering great differentiated value propositions. So,
I guess the point at the end of all this is that the UK is still an enormous market for tourism.
Correct.
And whatever happens, Brexit or not, it will still be that.
It always will be.
Fantastic. Well, I'm afraid that's all we have time for today. I'd like to thank you all for coming to what I think has been a very enlightening session. And I hope you'll join me in thanking our speakers today, Andrew Flinton from TUI, Chris Brown from EasyJet, Steve Byrne from Travel Counsellors, Stephen Cassidy from Hilton, and Caroline Bremner from Euromonitor. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for listening. We really hope you enjoyed our podcast from WTM London. I'm sure you'll agree it's been a brilliant event. We've had plenty of business done, lots of networking, and overall, I think everyone's had a really, really good time. We'll be back throughout the year releasing plenty more episodes with more global insights, interviews, travel news, and event sessions from WTM London.